Welcome to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, go to practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. A special guest today, an individual who has done much to elevate ethical standards in the practice of medicine during a decade with the Center for Practical Bioethics, and today as the Director of Ethics Education at Oregon Health Sciences University. He is a fellow at the center and a true gentleman and a scholar. Dr. Robert Potter, welcome back to Kansas City and the center.
Hello, LaRue.
Laurel.
Laurel. Laurel LaVou.
Yeah, there you go. Now, you're back in town for a number of reasons, including a lecture on Monday, April 6th. Before we get to that, though, tell us about what connected you with the center and drew you to its mission.
In 1984, I realized that something had to change. I'd been involved in practicing medicine and teaching medicine for the University of Kansas in a private setting, Bethany Medical Center, since 1970, but I'd always understood that there was something not quite right about medicine, and it was getting more and more demanding that I do something about that. And in 1984, I made the decision to take a break from practice of general internal medicine and attend the University of Chicago Divinity School, seeking a PhD in the area of religion, psychology, and ethics. At about the same time, this little organization called, at the time, Midwest Bioethics Center, was started, and they had an empty office down there on I-435 and a couple of people who were wandering around trying to figure out what to do with themselves. And it was kind of curious, you know. But I sort of kept my distance between 1984 and 1991. In 1991, however, I was back in practice, and things were beginning to happen, and I'd made some real contact with the center, invited them over to Bethany Medical Center to help us start an ethics committee and put in place the Patient Self-Determination Act, which was the piece that got advanced directives embedded in the hospital practice of medicine. And it was at that time that I became engaged with the center, attended a number of their seminars, and attended the Ethics Committee Consortium once a month. And as I finished up my PhD work in the fall of 1991, I felt a little more free to communicate with these folks, and I saw them developing from a distance. But I still, you know, expected them to be pretty much a little ragtag outfit that didn't quite know what it was doing with itself. Then it was one dark and stormy night.
The storyteller comes out.
One dark and stormy night. In March of 1984, Myra Christopher, executive of the center, asked me to meet her early before the Ethics Committee Consortium meeting, and there she invited me to work halftime at the center. So I was invited in to be on the staff to work as what we called it in its elevated sense, the ethics scholar. I now had my PhD and my MD, and I felt pretty cocky. And
you had enough initials after your name.
Right, I had enough initials that I thought I could manage to be a scholar of some sort. And so got into the Midwest Bioethics Center internal workings. And what grabbed me immediately was that the Joint Commission for Hospital Accreditation came to us just a few months after I had been hired on to become their teaching team for the entire nation in the area of their standards in patient rights and organizational ethics. And Myra and I crisscrossed this nation. You know, every couple of weeks we were out speaking to another cluster of 20 to 40 hospitals who had sent representatives to hear about these new standards in patient rights, which had to do, you know, with advanced directives and do not resuscitate orders and shared decision making, all the kind of stuff that we'd been working on here in Kansas City. And we really felt like we knew what we were talking about because the Kansas City folks had been our bioethics laboratory. We knew some stuff that worked and some stuff that didn't work, and we were able to share that around the nation, you know, all the time teaching out of this new list of patient rights and organizational ethics standards that were being imposed upon hospitals. And that really gave us a foothold in and visibility throughout the nations, and gave me at least a sense that I not only knew what I was talking about, but that I had the language on the tip of my tongue to do the talking. And it was a wonderful collusion of my interests, the center's interests, and the Joint Commission's interests, all wrapping that up into one, so that I had a really jump start into the bioethics world.
Now, you moved on to a lot of different things, including developing different kinds of guidelines over the years. Talk to us about that process and what kind of work you developed when it came into the world of guidelines.
Well, one of the areas that had been somewhat underdeveloped by the Joint Commission was this whole notion of organizational ethics. They had an idea that hospitals ought to participate in having their own ethical guidelines. What was it to be a corporation of integrity? But those were a little bit feeble. They didn't know quite how to talk about them. They didn't even know quite how to reinforce them when they had surveyors on the scene. And it was organizational ethics that I took off with. It's sort of my own direction. And in 1996, I published an article in the Journal of Clinical Ethics, which is still quoted to this day, I'm proud to say.
It's an amazing thing.
About organizational ethics. And what it allowed me to do there was to begin to make practical these organizational ethics expectations that hospitals as corporations ought to have of themselves, and that we as professionals ought to have of hospitals, and what patients and the public ought to have expectations of hospitals. And it was that working with hospital boards of directors, medical staffs, officers of one level or another around the country that helped solidify the whole notion of organizational ethics in healthcare.
Now, you've said in the past that the center practices a bipolar bioethics. Explain to us what you mean by that.
Of course, bipolar is a pathological term, and I didn't really mean that we do things pathologically, but rather that that using the term bipolar in more the chemistry sense, something that is bipolar, such as certain kinds of vitamins, is able to put one substance on one end of its molecule and another substance on the other end of its molecule and bring two substances together that ordinarily would not combine. It's like bringing oil and water together around a molecule of fat. So the Bioethics Center is able to bring divergent points of view together, not to get them necessarily to agree, but at least in the beginning to get them to talk to one another and to talk civilly with one another as to where there might be some agreement. And working that difference and working the difference towards agreement, I think, is one of the chief capacities of the center. It's the chief capacity of bioethics when it's doing its job well.
Now, Dr. Prater, I'm going to mention the name and ask for your reaction, okay?
Now, do I get a prize if I get it right?
Well, you get the prize of finishing this interview.
Okay. All right. I'm ready.
Okay. Let's begin with Myra Christopher.
Myra Christopher. Didn't she used to be a swimming coach in Johnson County?
She might have been. She's done a lot of things over the years.
Myra Christopher was this imposing Texas lady who is always going around giving people opportunities. And I was always pleased and proud to work with Myra Christopher as Executive Director of Midwest Bioethics Center and now as the Center for Practical Bioethics.
Bill Bartholomew.
Bill Bartholomew was one of those guys that you hated at first and then loved,
yeah,
finally. Bill Bartholomew was a professor of pediatrics and the history of medicine and involved with ethics at Kansas University School of Medicine. Bill was one of those kind of guys that when you got in an argument with him, you wish you hadn't. He was very, very wise and knowledgeable, but he was also very abrupt with his language. Bill was what was called a near founder of Midwest Bioethics Center because he was so involved, not only locally, but carried the message nationally. That is, whenever you'd go to a meeting of the American Society for Bioethics and Humanities or the Society for Health and Human Values, Bill Bartholomew would be there speaking out. You knew there was somebody in Kansas City connected with this outfit called the Center that had a voice. But Bill's voice began to fail when he came to us in 1995 to announce that he had a terminal esophageal cancer. But Bill's voice rang out for another 4.5 years as he struggled against his disease and helped us all realize that one of the most powerful messages that anyone who is dealing with end-of-life care can deliver is, how do you die well? Not how do you help other people die well, but how do you die well? And Bill taught us how to die well.
A final name to share, Rosemary Flanagan.
Rosemary Flanagan. Now, wasn't she that crazy nun who marched in Selma?
As a matter of fact, she was.
Yeah.
With another name back then, but
yeah, with another name
same
back
woman.
Then. Well, Rosemary Flanagan is one of those kinds of people that you just want to be around. Rosemary's always got a laugh. Rosemary's always got a wise idea. Rosemary always knows just what to do. And she was one of my conversation partners and the person that I would turn to if I say, how do you think we ought to do this, Rosemary? Her years as teaching philosophy at Rockhurst and her many years of dedication of working with Midwest Bioethics Center and now the Center for Practical Bioethics makes her a nun better than most.
Now, your lecture, April 6th, is entitled Band-Aids and Apples Don't Work Anymore, A Physician's Reflections on Bioethics. What wisdom will you share with us that evening?
Well, I'd like to know what that title is about. I'd actually like to know who made up that title. Somebody made it up.
Well,
for
I thought
me,
you
but,
made
but
it up.
No.
That
somebody,
sounds
I,
like
I,
you, though.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what they were trying to mimic me, and they did a pretty good job. What I want to say in that entire lecture is I give kind of an encapsulated quick history of what happened from 1984 to the present, what happened to the center, and what happened to me. Because this is not a history from a historian. This is a history from one who lived the history. So it's going to be sort of autobiographical as well as historical. What I want to say is that, in a nutshell, that in 1910, there was a report commissioned by the American Medical Association by an Abraham Flexner, a report that changed the direction of medicine. It shifted medicine from a almost charlatan-like profession to a scientific profession. But what they forgot to include was that Flexner said we need a balance of science and the humanities. And in this cluster called the humanities, that side of it, ethics, philosophy, theology, the personal side of things is embedded. We now have to start the 21st century with a new reading of the Flexner Report of 100 years ago and get that balance right between the technological science of medicine and the compassionate, humanistic, personal, ethical side of science.
Ladies and gentlemen, some people never really retire. They just keep moving on to the next challenge. And that's Dr. Robert Potter, and it was a pleasure having you on the Bioethics Channel today.
Thank you.
For more information about Dr. Potter's lecture, go to the Center's website at practicalbioethics.org. That's practicalbioethics.org. You've been listening to the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. I'm your host, Laurel LeBoon. See you next time on the Bioethics Channel.